Okay, we're in Shir Kali on the Parsha. We're in Parshat Toldot. In this Parsha, we have the birth, most prominently the birth of Yaakov and Esav. And not only do we have the birth of Yaakov and Esav, but we have the next stage in what's been a continuous process that we've talked about in some of the previous Shir Kalis this semester. A continuous selecting out process, a selection process. Where first we moved through those 10 generations until we were able to sift Avram Avinu out of the sands. And then we needed to select away Lot. Then even from within Avram Avinu, we select out Yishmael. And now, from Yitzchak, we have Yaakov and Esav, and we're selecting out Esav. What are some of the properties of this particular selection in this Parsha between Yaakov and Esav that are unique to Yaakov and Esav as opposed to any of the other selections that we've experienced so far in Sefer Bereishit? First one is twins. Yeah. In every previous instance, with Avram was against all the other nations of the world, all the other people of the world. Lot, they shared a same lineage. Avraham, they shared the same father, but not the same mother. Here, not only have the same mother and the same father, the same parents, but they're twins. They shared the same womb. They grew from the same place. They came from the same source. Somehow clearly getting closer and closer and closer together, already implying what we're going to start to unpack in this shiur, a more refined selection, a much closer selection between two twins. What else is unique about this selection? Dvorah?
It sort of seems like Esav was supposed to be selected and Yaakov was
back from him. Oh, we do that a lot in Sefer Bereishit. We're really good about that. Where there's somebody who's supposed to get it. I mean, that even goes down to Ephraim and Menashe, where nobody's going to claim that one is... both are tov, both are good. Nobody's selecting them out, but even there we're going to see a swap. That's a constant theme in the entirety of Sefer Bereishit, of the one who seemingly is supposed to get, or seems like they're supposed to get something. Seems to be like they're supposed to be more prominent and ends up not being the case. But in terms of the selection process itself, where are we now in the selection process? Okay, you can spoil the rest of Sefer Bereishit. Where are we now in the selection process? The end, yeah, thank you. Right? I don't want to give away the end of Parsha Toldot and Vayetze and Vayishlach, but this is it. Right? When Yaakov has kids, there's no selection process. Though perhaps, parentheses, that might be one layer of why there is a struggle between Yosef and his brothers. Maybe being unclear as to whether or not that selection process is over. Question mark. But in terms of the actual selection process as we know it, this is it. Yaakov and Esav is the final stage. Where Esav is selected out, Yaakov then becomes the Bechir HaAvot. He rises up. His name changes from Yaakov to Yisrael. And he produces B'nai Yisrael. He's finally able to do that. So where we are right now is at the final stage of selection within the context of Sefer Bereishit. And the nature of that selection, again, as you pointed out before, is between two twins. Between two people are totally similar to each other, both in terms of their origin. Again, they share the same mother, the same father, the same womb. They come from the same source in both the mother and the father. They share those genes in a very real way. These two individuals who are so similar, coming from such a close source, that for some reason needs to be the nature of that final selection in the process of Bereishit. So the question is, what then is the distinction between these two? What is the identity of Yaakov? What is the identity of Esav? Are they really similar? In what ways are they different? What is the nature of this last selection? In the beginning of your source sheets, I gave you the whole first chunk of the Parsha, the births of Yaakov and Esav. We'll read some of it together, but the whole paragraph is there. This is the whole opening of the Parsha. Starting from Pasuk Chav Dalet, Vayimlu Yamea Laledet V'nei Tomim BeVitna. She filled out the days until she gave birth, and there were, in fact, twins in her womb. Vayitzei harishon ad moni, the first one came out red, kulok aderet se'ar. He was like a whole, he was totally covered in hair. Vayikru shemo Esav, and they called him Esav. V'acharechein yatsa achiv, v'yado chezet ba'akev Esav, v'yikra shemo Yaakov, v'yitzchak ben shishim shana b'leret otam. And the second one came out, and his hand was grasping on to the akiv, to the heel of Esav, and therefore they called him Yaakov, and Yitzchak was 60 years when they were born. Then, v'yigdelu hane'arim. These two children grew up, and now the psukim give us are their first active distinction, meaning there's clearly a distinction in the fact that Yaakov is coming out, hairy as opposed to, sorry, Esav is coming out hairy versus Yaakov is coming out chalak, is coming out smooth. It's not in the psukim themselves, but Chazal tell us that's one of the distinctions between the two of them. The redness being a factor there as well, which is going to come and play in the same story in the bottom of the paragraph as well. But now they start to make their own distinctions. Vayigdelu ha'ne'arim, pasuk ha'zayin, vayihi Esav ish yodea tzayid, ish sadeh, v'yaakov ish tam yoshev ohalim. Esav is a person who knows tzayid. What does tzayid technically mean? What's the literal translation of tzayid? To trap. To understand what that means. Ish sadeh, man of the field, v'yaakov ish tam. Yaakov is, what is mazet tam? What does tam mean? Simple. We'll also figure that. I don't think anybody would go around saying, "Yeah, Yaakov, that simple guy in the back of the room, right?" When you have the child, the seder who's Tom, we don't think of Yaakov Avinu, right? So what does Tom mean here? What's the explanation of the word Tom? Yoshev Alim. Yeah. So we're going to definitely go in that direction. Yoshev Alim, who's sitting in the Ohel. We'll unpack it. So the first thing that Rashi points out, source number two in this pasuk that we're going to go into, pasuk of Zayin, Vayigdelu ha'ne'arim. Kol zman shayu ketanim lo hayu nikarim b'maaseihem ve'ein adam medagdik b'hem ma tivan. That these two truly were twins. They were incredibly similar. As most of this material is from my Rebbe Rav Amos, but as my Rebbe Rav Yol points out in other instances, when you think about Esav, you know, we have such a negative image of what Esav is, and it's 100% true. But you think about Esav for a moment. Yaakov and Esav, they both grew up in the house of Yitzchak and Rivka. You know, you got to imagine that Esau was pretty frum, right? The way that they were brought up, the parenting style, it's not even like they grew up, one was technically older and they're going to struggle over those few minutes or those few seconds when one came out first and the other was grabbing onto his heel. But there isn't even an age gap there. They both grew up in the home of Yitzchak and Rivka. And to think that Esau wasn't doing mitzvot growing up, that Esav wasn't involved in Avodas Hashem growing up, that's crazy to think. When he was a child, he's the son of Yitzchak and Rivka. So much so that Rashi here is bringing out that until they got to a certain age, until they got to 13, he says, but until they got to the point where they were taking responsibility for their actions, which is what the age of 13 by a man is and for a woman is, 12 by a woman, where they became responsible for their actions, that they were almost indistinguishable. They would mess up and they would call out Esav and they meant Yaakov. They call it Yaakov, they meant Esav, right? Every parent does that. They were basically indistinguishable. And then that moment happens where they start to identify who they are. They begin to create their identities, begin to manifest, and that's what's happening in this pasuk. Vayigdelu ha'ne'arim. They're no longer na'arim. And they're defining who they are. And the distinction that the Torah gives us in its classic, very, very few words that are meant to contain a lot, is that Esav is an ish yodea tzayid ish sadeh, as opposed to Yaakov is an ish tam yoshev olim. So mazda ish yodea tzayid ish, that's not telling us the difference in their profession. That's not interesting. Got to have a little bit more than that. One went out and trapped in the field, and one was sitting there in the tent. I'm talking about Yaakov and Esav. So what does it mean that Esav was an ish yodea tzayid ish sadeh? So Rashi, in the same pasuk, quoting Chazal, says the following. And the Mefarshim on Rashi point out that he's learning this out, that if it wanted to tell us that he was somebody who went out and trapped animals, that he was a trapper, that that's what his job was, it would have called him a trapper. But it says no, he was nishio day outside, he knew how to trap. Why switch around the lashon like that? Because what does your day outside here mean really? Say Chazal, Rashi quotes it, latsud vilirmot et aviv befiv. He was able to trap and to trick his father with his words. That the nature of the ability to trap of Esav was the ability to utilize his language, utilize his speech, to convince people that he was someone that he was not. More dramatically, to convince even his father that he was a tzaddik when he was not. Look at the continuation of Rashi here, again based on Chazal. V'sho'alo, he would go to his father and say, Abba, Yitzchak, he'ach ma'asrin ata melach ve'ata teven. How do I take ma'aser from melach and teven? K'savur aviv shu medakdik b'mitzvot, to show his father, to make his father think that he actually cared about the mitzvot. Yodea tzayid, he was full of trickery. He was the first person, in a way that's really manifest in Chumash, to present himself one way, even though he was somebody totally different. And this is in contrast to Yaakov. Yaakov was an ish tam yoshev ohalim. What does it mean that Yaakov is an ish tam? So Rashi's following the same shita. Take a look at tam in source number 2. He wasn't a bucky in all of these things. He wasn't able to figure out how to trick people on this and that and the other thing. No. Ela kilibo kein befiv. Whatever was in his heart, that's what came out of his mouth. That was the core difference that's being brought out here in this very short pasuk, in terms of the integral distinction between Yaakov and Esav. Esav is the one who's portraying himself as being the tzaddik, who, as we say in Hebrew, the phrase is echad bepeh ve'echad belev. He was one way in his mouth, echad bepeh, but in his heart he was totally different. As opposed to Yaakov, who's totally different, he's totally the opposite, and he's piva vilibo shavim. Exactly as he is on the outside, that's who he is on the inside. And we're talking about here is a new type of identity that's possibly much more dangerous, much more horrifying than we've ever had before. We talked about the distinctions between Yishmael, not really between Yishmael and Yitzchak, we talked about Yishmael in terms of who he was a few weeks ago in Shir Kali. And there we talked about issues of breaches of chesed and issues of ta'ava and issues of all kinds of problems in terms of midot that we want to totally stay away from. And they need to be removed from the system. But here we have someone for the first time who is a rasha, who tries to come off as a tzaddik. This concept of creating a cover-up and a facade of someone who's the complete opposite. What traits do those represent? If we talk about somebody who's putting forth a facade and is one way, but portraying himself totally different, as opposed to somebody who is exactly as they appear to be, what two midot, what two concepts are we pulling between? Go for it. Thank you. Yes, it's in the title. Emet and Sheker. It's on the top of your sheet, source number 0. It's the title. Right? It's this struggle between Emet and Sheker. Two things that perhaps are more fundamentally different than anything else in reality. And the difficulty in distinguishing between the two. The whole essence of what Sheker is what is Sheker? When somebody's telling a lie, when somebody's portraying themselves as something, what they're basically saying is I am something else. Not just I am something else, but what is Sheker trying to say? Not just that I'm something else, what am I trying to say? If I'm Sheker, what am I trying to say? I am truth. That's the only thing that's really important to me within the context of that lie, is to clarify that I am actually telling you the truth, even though I'm lying. And truth inherently is truth. You have these two things that are warring against each other, both fighting to claim primacy, both fighting to claim that they are the real truth. The lie that says it's the truth, and the actual truth itself. Now that's push and pull between Emet and Sheker only lasts for a certain amount of time. The Gemara tells us very powerfully. Source number 3. The Emet. Oh, it's the second. Sorry, the second half of that quote after the question mark. Kushta kai shikra lo kai. That at the end of the day, kushta in Aramaic means emet. Say it in Brish Shmei when we take out the Torah. Oraita kshot that Kadosh Baruch Hu is true and the Torah is true. Kshot means emet, truth. Kushta kai, truth stands. Shikra lo kai, sheker cannot stand. The sheker will ultimately not be able to stand the test of time. Now that's both meant literally and metaphorically. It's beautifully represented in the letters. I can't draw block letters. I don't know if it's going to help so much. Anybody here able to draw block letters? No one. Thank you. Put up the word emet.
What do you mean block letters? Like
models?
Yeah.
Oh, like that. She figured it out. She's good. No, you don't have to make it all fancy. Just like the actual letter itself. Yeah. Aleph, mem, and tav.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
And sheker. Excellent. That's it. When I write notes on the board, people don't know what it means anyway, so it doesn't really matter whether it's block letters or scripts. Emet and sheker. But if you look at sheker, kushtakai, shikra lokai. That if you even take a look at the structure of the words themselves, the structure and the essence of a word is always contained within the letters in Lashon HaKodesh. If you take a look at sheker, all of the letters of sheker, they're unable to stand on their own. They eventually will fall. The shin ends at one point, the kuf only has one point, one leg, and the resh only has one leg. Sheker ain't okay. Sheker can't stand. It eventually will fall. As opposed to emet, where the aleph has two legs, the mem has a straight bottom, and the tav has two legs to it. Even in the essence of the word itself, emet will stand. But sheker, inherent in the word and the letters themselves, sheker is doomed to eventually fall. If you leave sheker long enough, if you fight the sheker long enough, eventually it will reveal that it is the sheker, that it's not the emet, and it will fall. Sheker cannot be eternal. And this is something that we're struggling with over time. Through a large portion of the history of the world. Let's come back to a concept we've also discussed a few weeks ago, but is something which plays a deep role all throughout Chumash. We talked a few weeks ago, we presented this concept of there being four malchuyot. We saw it in its original form, its earliest form, which is sources number 4 and 5 on your sheets, which we saw a few weeks ago, the sources as well. That all the way down to the creation of the world itself is built in this concept of there needing to be four galiyot, four stages of exile. That Klal Yisrael has to go through these four stages of exile until they can eventually, finally come forth as the clear, dominant power in the world, reflecting HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the world. What are those four malchuyot? Taken from, again, one of many sources, Tov, Vo, Choshech, and Penei Tehom, source number 5. Va'aretz Hayitzah Tov, Zo Galut Bavel. Tov is Galut Bavel, the first one is the Babylonian exile. Bohu Zo Galut Madai, the Persian Median exile is Bohu. Choshech, which is now becoming very relevant to the Rosh Chodesh Kislev coming up this week. Choshech ze galut Yavan, shecheshichu enehem shel Yisrael begziro tehem. The third galut is Yavan, Greece, which tries to darken the eyes of Israel, and we try to respond with that with light in that darkness. And then we finally have the last stage, al pnei tehom, along the surface of the deep. Zo galut mamlechat harisha. That's the exile of the evil kingdom, which is always associated with Edom. We'll see other sources that indicate that very clearly very soon. The last stage is Galut Edom. That long, hard, final exile, indicated even within the word itself. What words are linking to the Galut of Edom, even in its most basic form in Bereshit? What are the words which Edom comes from? Louder? From the Midrash, quoting the Pasuk. Which words? Al pnei tehom. Across the surface of the deep. The sense of this extending out, going forth, extending long over the surface of the deep, the tehom, which is deep. This long, hard, drawn out, final galut. of Edom that's going to be the longest and hardest exile that we're going to have to go through. Until again, as we saw previously, but taking a look at the end of the drash, until finally, Ruach Elokim merachepet al panei hamayim, until Yemot HaMashiach comes, that Ruach Elokim, which is Rucho Shel Mashiach, coming through the tshuva that we do, which is Shifke Mayim Lebe, because that mayim at the end of the pasuk. Putting those two things together, what that means is that the long, hard, final exile that we're going to experience, and the struggle of the fourth layer of that exile, is that struggle of Emet versus Sheker. Is that struggle between two things that are going to look incredibly similar, and having to have the fortitude to figure out who am I and what am I on the contrast of that thing? What is really the truth? You know, you watch the progression of the Galiot, and we hinted to this when we talked about this in Parshat Lech Lecha. But let's open it up a little bit. You look at those four Galiot, and we talked about the fact that if they're built into the fabric of creation, it's not just we sin, we get thrown out, we sin, we get thrown out, we sin, we get thrown out. They're saying that there's four stages of Galut. It could be that we could achieve Melech HaMashiach before we have to get through all four stages, but if we're going in those stages, they're very intentionally. Bavel, Prasumadai, Yavan, Edom. Very intentionally structured that way from the second Pasuk of the Torah, from the very fabric of creation itself. And watch what's happening after each one. First, who comes after us first? Babel. Where we're attacked barbarically, we're destroyed. There was certainly no concept in those times of Jews raising their hand and becoming mit bavlim. Nobody was running to become a Babylonian. We knew that that was not us. Then we get one step further down. What's the next exile? Pras and Madai. What story does that encompass? The Purim story. Now, we didn't want to become Persians per se, but how does the story of Megillat Esther open up? Ahasuerus comes about, and what do we do? We're participating in the, we're going to the party, and we're participating, we're starting to become part of that culture. Then we get to the next stage, which is Yavan, which is which story? Hanukkah. Then what do you have for the first time? You have assimilation. Even what word do we produce? Mit Yavnim. There's something so appealing about what Yavan has to offer. There's something that's so much more intrinsically linked to who we are that we're able to confuse that and even jump over to the side of adopting Greek culture as our own. And that struggle is inherent, again, also from the birth of Yavan himself. Yavan, as we talked about, comes from who? From Bnei Noach? Yefet. Yaft Elokim liyefet v'yishkon bo'ale shem. There's a beauty to Yefet which is meant to exist within the tent of shame. Already, when we're going back to that root where he's born from, even going back to Yefet, there's an understanding that there might be an interest, that there is a reality of Yefet, of Yavan, that can even exist within the context of Judaism, that can exist within the context of Torah. But it has to exist within us. But when we need up, but when we get confused and give up who we are for that, we totally miss the point. Because they valued beauty, they valued art, they valued culture, but only on the external level. So we were able to give up who we were because there was something very attractive about that. Then we come to the final, long, and most difficult stage. Because each stage we're getting more and more closer. The distinctions, when we go into exile at the beginning, we're going into exile, we know we had a mistake. We have to figure out who we are to come back. Then we have to figure out who we are in contrast to Prasamadi, who we are in contrast to Yavan, and suddenly now we're in the longest, hardest distinction process. Both back in its root in Yaakov and Esav, and for all of history, going through Galut Edom, where Edom is challenging us and asking us who we are in contrast to something which is very, very similar to we are. When the Sfarim discuss what Malchut Edom is, how do they understand Malchut Edom? A Malchut, and this applies to all the previous Malchiyot as well that we talked about, Bavel, Prasumada, Yavan, it doesn't just mean the strongest physical might in the world, it also means that. What it means is it's the dominant world culture. Whatever culture is dominating the reality of the world at that time, that's the Malchut. It has to be complete. It has to be total. In the times of the destruction of Ba'icheni and moving into Galut Edom, what was the dominant world force at the time? Who were the dominant world force? Say louder. Rome. And the first earliest sources are going to link up Edom and Rome. How did Rome identify originally? And religiously, if you will. Before then. They were pagans first. They were first pagans. And they originally started off by persecuting Christians. But eventually what happened?
One of their emperors converted.
And they adopted Christianity. And that's what became the dominant world religion and the dominant world power and the dominant world force. What was the claim of Christianity? When it rose, what was the claim? Was it you're wrong? Was it God? Was it this is true and that's false?
God like made a new people.
Did he make a new people? And did what?
And sent himself.
Well, not to that detailed extent. Yes, right. Not he chose them. The Christians came up and said, we are the Jews. We are the new Jews. It's not that you're wrong. It's not that there was no Torah. It's not that there was no Judaism before. It's not that there was a mistake up until this point. Now there's a revelation in the world and now it's all true. It's saying, no, we are the new Jews. We are an extension. We are the next stage of who you are. We are you. And you are us. And I don't know what you're fighting about anymore. And there was this push and push and push to convert because you are us. This manifestation of sheker in the sense of putting oneself forth as you. I am you. I am the tzaddik. I am the emet. When deep down, the core is sheker. It's a crazy thing. It's a frightening thing. That's the struggle that we went out throughout history against the Roman Empire in its expressions through Christianity. Now I don't think that, and again, it's not my thinking. Now we no longer assume that Christianity is the dominant reflection of Edom, but Edom is often associated in these times as being Western culture itself, as my Rebbe puts it in his, you know, strong way. If you have a McDonald's everywhere in the world and Coca-Cola everywhere in the world, then Western culture is officially the dominant culture of the world. Everybody is looking to copy what we do here in the rest of the world. We're extending as far out as possible. But that reality of Western culture, and this, just like Greek culture before it with its own issues, is the dominant world culture. We have to figure out what that has to relate to as well. But let's come back a little bit more and start to link things in. In terms of that being what Edom is, that being what that Malchut is all about, so we talked about how throughout all of Chazal, anytime there are going to be fours, almost every time, they're going to link them back to different Malchuyot. So much so, even to this extent. Wow. Take a look at this source. Let's not take a look at the source, we're running out of time. When the Torah puts forth the four non-kosher animals. There are four non-kosher animals. So Chazal immediately jumped to the same thing they always do, linking them to each one, to one of the galiot, and then how they line up. Which non-kosher animal do Chazal immediately link up to Esav, to Edom? The chazir. Why the chazir of all of the other ones? What's unique about the chazir that's not true of any of the other non-kosher animals? Its hooves are split, but it doesn't chew its cud. Meaning, on the outside, it looks kosher. It's claiming to be kosher. It's claiming to be emet. But on the inside, that's where the sheker exists. But as you follow throughout Chazal, that's the main issue that we're struggling in all ways with Esav and with Edom throughout history. What that hints to is what that's trying to tell us is, it says we're going through this galut of Edom. is that what we desperately need to do and figure out, and it's so relevant, it should hopefully be resonant to us. But it's certainly, if one looks out at the world outside, it's pervasive. Is to fight against a world to define who we are. In so many ways, the outside world, starting with Christianity, claimed, we are you and you are us. We're one and the same. Forcing us to figure out, but really, who am I? Forcing us to think about, and this certainly bleeds into issues of Western culture, the prominence of creating a facade, of putting myself forth as somebody else. Think about the postmodern reality that we live in and the generation that we live in. So much of the world and of what we do and of what we obsess over is not just who we are, but the only thing more important than who I am is, who do I present myself as? What identity do I build up of myself? Do I want to be? What content do I want to fill? Do I want to make myself and present that to the outside world? Think about realities like a person goes on Facebook. And that certain people, when they go on Facebook, they build up whole new identities for themselves. Where their panim, their outward face, is one thing. And they're trying to portray themselves to their world and to the world in a certain way. That in fact is intentionally different than who they are on the inside. How do I dress? What do I wear? How do I act? What do I say? What do I quote? What do I pretend to know? We're defined by so much of who we define ourselves by, because the outside world is telling us to do that. Isn't how we present ourselves, not in who we are. And in this generation, you look around, and if you have a job like mine, but even if you just look around, you think about some of your friends, hopefully not, but you think about some of your friends, you think about people you know, who look so strong on the outside, so confident on the outside, so put together on the outside, so broken on the inside, but never letting that show. Because the most important thing is what I am out there. It doesn't matter if I know who I am. It doesn't matter if I like myself. It doesn't matter if I care about myself. It doesn't matter where my self-esteem is. My self-esteem could be in the toilet. As long as I come out with confidence, that's the most important thing. Who am I on the outside is the prominence of Western culture. We've talked about this in other instances, but a little taste of it, pun intended. I don't have the time to go all the way into something like this. But you look in the modern, even the way we produce food in the modern world. You go and you walk down the aisles in a grocery store, and you have 18 different things that are portraying themselves as being X. You have 18 things that are telling you that they're pasta. You have 18 things that are telling you that they're cereal, whatever they are. And you look at the back of the box, and it's anything but. The ingredients have no correlation to the food that was produced at all. And because of that, it's bereft of its essence, bereft of its content. There's no nutritional value to those types of foods. You, those of you who know me know that we could go farther into that. We're not going to. But that's another presentation of the modern world. The people who stand at the top of the modern world, the people who are idolized by the outside world, people who make the most money, people who people look up to, the people who are on the cover of magazines, actors and actresses. Who do we idolize? People who are able to so completely take on a different identity that if I watched them, I would believe that they were somebody else. That's what I'm looking up to. That's what our society is prizing. There was once happened to have read this article. There was a studio executive who thought she was on the way out, and she wasn't on the way out. Didn't matter, her career was fine anyway, for better or for worse. But when she thought she was on the way out, she started to talk a little bit more than she should, and she said, having worked with so many actors and actresses, that in her experience, they're all just bottomless pits of need. That was her way of describing them. That there's nothing inside. Because if we take it a little bit of a step deeper in the 2 minutes that we have left, take it a little bit of a step deeper. When I'm trying to be somebody else, when something is trying to be something else, what does it mean? What doesn't it have? We've hinted at this in the whole discussion for the last 10 minutes. What doesn't it have? And a what?
Substance.
Doesn't have an identity of its own. It's totally empty. Again, you look at even where one manifestation of Edom, where Christianity came from, where it started with as paganism. It took from Judaism, it took from paganism, then it took from monotheistic religions. It's taken from everywhere else. But it has no firm identity of its own. Nor does it claim to it. The interfaith panel a few weeks ago, every time I would say something, right, they were all just sitting there and nodding. Because up to a certain point, everything I said that they agreed with. They agreed with everything that I said. They just, after that, things changed. But gather in, because there's no sense of identity, there's no sense of core identity. Simply, we don't know who we are. We're a generation, more than any other generation, we don't know who we are. We're struggling in that search for longer and longer and longer periods of time to try and figure that out. Because we have no way to figure out how to do that, and because we're so busy building up those other identities, trying to pull from this and that in this postmodern reality. I'm pulling from this and pulling from that, and I'm building this structure of who I am, but it's not me, and I don't know who I am. All the way back to the first pasuk in Bereshit. Tohu, vo, choshech, what was Edom? Al panei tohom. What does that mean, literally? Over the surface of the deep. Does that have any identity? It's not tohu, it's not bo, it's not choshech. It's taking all of the other galiot, it's taking everything that came before, and then merging it together and spreading it out eternally and claiming that it's something. With no sense of what it is. It's a painful reality that we're fighting. But it's an empowering reality that we're fighting, that we're in this fourth stage of exile. We're fighting Galut Edom. We're fighting the Galut of Esav. We're fighting the Galut of Risha. That this reality is where we're being pushed, where everything looks like us and everything looks like it could be us, and is demanding of us as Jews that despite the way the outside world looks, to figure out what is, who am I? What is a Jew? How am I, me as a Jew? Figuring out those two things, my self-identity, figuring out who I am, and what does it mean that I am a Jew? In contrast to all those other things that look good, that look like they're Tov, that look like they're the Tzaddik, but are really Esav and really Ra. Working to figure that out. That's the struggle here between Yaakov and Esav. It's the struggle in life between Edom and Klal Yisrael. It's the struggle of the last Malchut that we're in. B'srat Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, should give us Yad HaDishmaya, that we should be able to overcome the influences of the outside world, figure out who we really are, to shed the layers of Sheker that we've built up upon ourselves, all of us, myself included, as we've tried to forge our own identities and figure out who we truly are as Yaakov Ishtam, he just is who he is, to rise up and be that Yaakov Avinu, and for that to be able to see the rise of Klal Yisrael, who will bring forth the Geula by showing the Malchut of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the only Emet that there truly is. Chotamo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Emet, God's signature is truth. When that Emet finally comes out into the world, Yimei HaRabbi Aminu.